Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Maria Fries of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, who examines the controversial proposals for deep cuts in Social Security made by the co-chairs of President Obama's Deficit Commission. Allison Fisher of Public Citizens Energy Program, who assesses the environmental damage caused by a new natural gas drilling method known as fracking, which has polluted groundwater and endangers human health. And Osama Khalil of Al-Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, who talks about why he believes new Middle East peace talks will fail if Washington refuses to pressure Israel to make substantive concessions to comply with international law. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The months of political gridlock in Iraq did not stop Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki from opening up oil fields in southern Iraq to foreign oil companies. Meanwhile, the Iraqi government has continued its repression against trade unions that are harsh critics of the effort to privatize the country's rich oil sector. Since the 2003 invasion, oil workers' unions have battled U.S. and Iraqi officials over granting millions of dollars worth of oil leases to foreign companies. In 2007, oil workers in Iraq shut down oil pipelines in protest over high unemployment and the effort to privatize oil resources. According to The Nation magazine, Prime Minister Maliki called in the Iraqi army with U.S. fighter protection to harass oil workers. In recent years, the oil workers have blasted the use of production sharing agreements between the government and foreign companies. These deals are rare in Arab countries because too much power and revenue is given away to oil firms from Europe, the United States, Russia, and China. Other Iraqi trade unions have suffered harassment from the Maliki government. Last July, electric utility workers were expelled from their office in Basra as billions of dollars in power plant contracts went out for bids. General Electric won over $3 billion in Iraqi infrastructure deals. In a dramatic cost-cutting move, British Prime Minister David Cameron has delayed the program to replace the current generation of Trident nuclear missiles and submarines. According to the Guardian newspaper, the date of authorizing a new fleet of nuclear submarines has been pushed back until 2028. These military cuts were announced as part of Britain's stark austerity budget released in mid-October in conjunction with the new coalition government's defense policy review. Britain's Royal Navy will have to wait another 10 years for 50 new Stryker aircraft. But Cameron, the Conservative Prime Minister, has decided to finish building two aircraft carriers, the Prince of Wales and Queen Elizabeth, which will cost over $6 billion. The decision to complete both carriers has come under harsh criticism from the opposition Labour Party due to high cost overruns at a time when most social safety net programs are being slashed. The decision to put off a new generation of Trident nuclear missiles has upset the most right-wing elements in the Conservative Party. The wave of Conservative Republicans elected as governors in states like Wisconsin, Florida, and Maine could grind health care reform to a halt. Over the next 4 years, governors and state legislators will be the key decision makers, setting up new insurance exchanges to buy health insurance and imposing new regulations on insurance companies. Already, the new governors-elect in Kansas, Oklahoma, Wisconsin, and Wyoming have promised to sign onto the lawsuit challenging the federal government's right to require that every American buy health insurance by 2014. According to the Los Angeles Times, Republicans now control state legislatures in 25 states. Many of the newly elected governors, like Rick Scott in Florida, a former health care executive, campaigned against the new health care reform law, calling it the single largest government power grab in history. Resistance to health care reform has also emerged in state legislatures in Minnesota and Rhode Island, recently rejecting bills to set up insurance exchanges. There may also be battles around the law that requires governors to extend Medicaid coverage to 19 million more low-income Americans. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
The co-chairs of President Obama's National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform dropped a bombshell on November 10th when they released a set of controversial proposals designed to rein in America's ballooning debt. The co-chairs, former U.S. Senator from Wyoming Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles, chief of staff under President Clinton, presented a set of recommendations that include raising the Social Security retirement age to 69 by 2075, substantial cuts in Social Security and Medicare benefits, eliminating 200,000 federal jobs by 2020, raising the federal gas tax by 15 cents per gallon, reducing the corporate income tax, eliminating the mortgage interest deduction, reducing the number of U.S. troops in Europe and Asia, and canceling some Pentagon weapons programs. The co-chair's draft report was greeted with strong objections from both the left and right. But analysis of the plan found that the proposal depended more on spending cuts than increased revenue, tied closely to conservative doctrine. However, most observers believe it's unlikely that the full 18-member commission report, due by December 1st, will receive the 14 votes required to send along a deficit reduction plan to Congress. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Maria Fries, Director of Government Relations and Policy at the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. She explains why her group opposes deep cuts to Social Security and the need to organize a strong coalition to resist efforts to place the burden of deficit reduction on the backs of the poor and the middle class.
We have been concerned about this commission ever since President Obama created it by executive order. We have been trying to communicate with them to make sure that they understood what our views were. We would start with the argument that Social Security does not belong in this discussion, period. Social Security, this is a deficit commission, as you mentioned. Social Security is not contributing to the deficit. In fact, it's still in surplus. It has trillions of dollars in its trust fund that have been accumulated over the years because baby boomers have been overpaying their payroll taxes, partly so that they could build up these surpluses so that they could draw down on them as they started to retire. So this is really not necessary to do this right now. Yes, 30 years out, there's a little gap in the anticipated benefits coming in, revenue coming in versus benefits that are going to be paid out, but it's almost 30 years out in the future, and at this point, it's just projected. What they have done is they are locking into statute, if they decide to do these recommendations, much deeper cuts than you would end up with if you just did nothing and let the trust funds all be paid out as benefits. So we're very troubled by it. They basically took every bad idea that that has been out there, and they've combined it into one proposal. We're mostly focused on Social Security because that's the program that we think people are least likely to understand. There are people who have opposed Social Security have spent so much money over the past 10 years trying to convince people that it's in crisis and it's almost bankrupt and it's not going to be there for them and all that, that we feel like we're fighting this tidal wave to try to make sure that people understand that it's actually in much better financial condition than they've been led to believe. So we're not surprised by these proposals.
Maria, what's the process ahead? What happens next with this commission, and what will the now divided Congress do with any proposals that might come out of this commission?
Well, that's actually a very good question, Scott. What we have been told, and there's not a whole lot of information that you can get about this commission, but what we've been told is that their committees are going to be meeting to review the co-chair's proposal and to see if they have their own proposals. They have been encouraged to bring their own proposals to the table. And then presumably they will figure out whether there is a critical mass of votes for any piece, or I find it almost impossible to believe that they could get 14 votes for the entire package. The question from we don't know is, are there component pieces of this that can get 14 votes or get 10 votes or 12 votes? Congress is committed, the Senate is committed, Senator Reid, back in the spring, I believe, committed to holding a vote if they can get 14 votes, holding a vote in the Senate, and Speaker Pelosi agreed that if a bill passed the Senate, she would bring it up in the House. There's not a lot of time left for this to happen this calendar year. And in fact, it's not clear whether technically they're going to be able to do it because of the need to actually get some revenue scores. This proposal is very, shall we say, opaque in terms of how much money it's actually going to raise. So they're going to have to get some hard and fast numbers before many people want to vote on it. It's a possibility that you could still end up with a vote in the next month, but personally, I think it's a long shot. Where the danger, I believe, I see in this proposal is that if it appears as though there is some consensus behind pieces, Social Security in particular, I could see parts of it or all of it as part of the president's budget submission next year. I could see fiscally conservative Republicans in particular in the House insisting on some of these changes in exchange for their willingness to vote for the increase in the debt limit that's going to be facing them probably in the early spring. So this issue is not going to go away.
The Republican Party for many years now has had a mission to destroy the nation's social safety net, and particularly the New Deal programs put in place under Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the Great Depression. Is there a viable coalition that you're working with now that will rise up to oppose deep cuts in Social Security and the other elements of the nation's social safety net?
We are constantly out trying to put together other coalitions, get support from other groups. Part of the problem has been up until now, I don't think anybody believed the program was at risk because nobody really believed us that they were going after Social Security. And that's why, frankly, I'm hoping that one of the things we're going to be able to achieve out of this co-chair's report is we're going to finally be able to convince people that there is a serious risk here. And it's a serious risk moving forward that elements, very bad elements of this proposal will end up resurfacing and will end up actually being implemented. And that's a bad thing for the country. And it's a bad thing, frankly, for Americans and for middle-income Americans.
That was Maria Fries, Director of Government Relations and Policy at the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Contact the group by calling area code 202-216-0420 or visit their website at ncpssm.org. Hydraulic fracturing or fracking, a relatively new way to access natural gas locked in shale formations located deep underground, has led to increased drilling in many states around the country. One area is the Marcellus Shale Formation in Pennsylvania, which extends to most of West Virginia and parts of New York State near New York City. One gas company executive claimed on a recent 60 Minutes segment that the U.S. holds in natural gas deposits the equivalent of two Saudi Arabia's worth of oil. Natural gas is considered by many a bridge fuel to cleaner energy because it emits much less carbon dioxide than coal or oil. But the process of fracking, in which millions of gallons of water, a secret mix of toxic chemicals, and sand are injected into wells to break apart shale and release trapped gas, is raising pollution concerns throughout the U.S. The drilling method has polluted groundwater, created contaminated industrial sites in some rural areas, and caused illnesses, according to people who live near fracking operations. New York State has declared a short-term moratorium on fracking in the Delaware watershed, which provides drinking water to New York City. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Allison Fisher, Director of Outreach for Public Citizens Energy Program. She explains why some environmentalists favor the development of natural gas resources, but cautions that fracking should be halted, at least until the results of an Environmental Protection Agency study are released.
The best case scenario for a lot of people, certainly for environmentalists, is this idea of natural gas. So I think it's kind of a false dichotomy that's been set up. You know, and I think its abundance is very appealing. The fact that it's domestic is very appealing. But you have to remember that we still have, you know, sun and we have wind and we have some other resources that are domestic as well. And they don't come with the trappings of all of the environmental and safety issues that natural gas does. And certainly natural gas that's coming to us from hydraulic fracking.
I know people in Pennsylvania and maybe other states are finding that their wells are contaminated with chemicals used in fracking. But the whole issue of water use in the process, talk about that. It takes a tremendous amount of water, right?
It is a tremendous amount of water. My understanding of that is something to the tune of either 1 to 5 million gallons per well. And those wells are drilled or extracted from sometimes multiple times, so that escalates the amount of water that's used. So, you know, and it's an interesting question that's posed because, you know, I think that there's this fallback that says, well, you know, if we tighten up the standards, the environmental standards, the safety standards, and we increase the accountability of this industry, then maybe this is an acceptable technology. But what's problematic about that is that these companies, this industry, is already off and running. This is not a question that we're posing at the beginning of potentially pursuing this technology. This is happening. It's been happening, and it's starting to increase in a very alarming way, particularly over the Marcellus Shale and on the East Coast, where they've really started to tap into some of these resources, you know, in communities that are not familiar with this technology at all and that see an opportunity to support their families by, you know, selling their land, their mineral rights to industries that are basically telling them that there's going to be no consequence.
Allison Fisher, do property owners sell the land and move away or just sell the mineral rights and stay put?
It gets very complicated because there is no federal regulation. So the regulations that are overseeing this technology is state by state. So having this patchwork that has to happen from a regulatory standpoint across all of these states is very complicated. And the kind of antidote to that is having, you know, federal regulations. And right now, hydraulic fracking is exempt from, my understanding, not just from Safe Water Drinking Act, but the Clean Air Act as well, and of course the National Environmental Policy Act. You know, not having them monitored or overseen this industry in any way is very problematic.
Is that the Halliburton loophole, the one that was included in the 2005 federal energy bill when Vice President Dick Cheney, who's the former Halliburton CEO, was in office?
The Halliburton loophole is in reference specifically to the Safe Water Drinking Act, which basically means they're exempt from that. And this is where this idea of the chemicals that they're using, that they don't have to disclose them. You know, that's been just one of the regulatory gaps that needs to be filled in, and there's others. But right now, it seems that the big issue that's on the radar is, what are these chemicals? What are they using? What are they pumping into the earth, and what's coming back out by way of the flow water? What's happening right now is that the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, has initiated a new study to look at hydraulic fracking, to look at the chemicals, to look at the impacts, and create a broader study about what hydraulic fracking is and what it's going to mean for the industry and for the country moving forward. One of the things that they are focusing on is the chemicals, the fracking fluid, it's called. And historically, companies have claimed proprietary information, saying that this is a special company recipe that if we divulge, then this could hurt our profits, this could make us less competitive if we're to let the ingredients out of the bag. So they've been able to claim that to keep them from having to divulge this information, information that the public needs, information that workers should have access to, and regulators and anybody overseeing this industry. The EPA study, which got initiated, I believe in February of this year, is not due to be released or completed until 2012. So it would stand to reason that while we're asking all these questions and have very few answers, that there shouldn't be any drilling going on. There should be a nationwide moratorium stopping this technology and these processes until, at minimum, until we get the EPA report that seeks to address a lot of the questions that are on the table.
That was Allison Fisher of Public Citizens Energy Program. Contact their D.C. office at area code 202-546-4996 or visit their website at citizen.org.
After several months of stalled peace negotiations between the Israelis and Palestinians, the Obama administration is hoping to broker a deal for a 90-day construction freeze, temporarily halting Israel's expansion of West Bank settlements. This would exclude East Jerusalem, and the U.S. is reportedly offering Israel concessions, including a pledge not to seek any further construction freezes, the sale of 20 advanced U.S. fighter jets, acceptance of Israeli forces in the Jordan Valley, and a commitment to oppose international efforts to impose a political solution on Israel. Direct talks between Israelis and Palestinians broke off after a previous settlement freeze expired on September 26th. While Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu faces opposition to extending the freeze from many in his right-wing cabinet, Palestinians are asking why Israel should receive incentives from the U.S. for stopping settlement expansion, which is in violation of international law. One of the proposed solutions to the dispute over Israeli settlements is to cede to the Palestinians land inside Israel in exchange for the existing settlements within the West Bank. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Osama Khalil, co-director of the group Al-Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, who talks about why he believes new Middle East peace talks will fail if Washington refuses to pressure Israel to make substantive concessions to comply with international law.
This is a one-time-only 90-day freeze. And according to the press reports, I mean, some of this is still a bit vague, but according to the press reports, what we're seeing is a real diminishing of Palestinian rights, not only territorially, but within international organizations, including the UN. And what do I mean by that? According to some of the press reports, what's being reported is that the United States would support, in return for a 60 to 90-day freeze on settlements, which, again, does not include East Jerusalem, which compromises about half the number of settlements and settlers. Among the reported concessions by the Obama administration was control to Israel over the Jordan River Valley for some unspecified set of time. One assumes it would be something like a 99-year lease. So this is a huge chunk of territory bordering between Jordan and what would be a Palestinian state, which would be controlled by the Israeli military. So what does that mean? In reality, that means that Israel will control the borders of this Palestinian state, so that the key fundamental component of sovereignty for any state is the control of your borders, who comes in, who comes out, how much freedom of access of people, of trade, etc. Israel will control this. At a second level, the fact that it is now blocking and has agreed to block any attempt by the Palestinians at the UN or other international bodies to obtain recognition for an independent state without a final peace agreement is another huge blow to Palestinian efforts, again, to negotiate not only a peace but to achieve an independent state that fulfills the basic and fundamental rights of everyone on this planet, which is the right to freedom and to live in dignity. And that is actually being denied, and it's being actively denied, not only by the Obama administration, but, of course, other American administrations. So this isn't much of a difference. It's not going to lead to much. And, in fact, what it's only going to do is further entrench Israel's occupation and further weaken the hands of Palestinians in this moderate Palestinian leadership that supposedly the Obama administration is attempting to support and to promote in the region.
I wanted to ask you about the prospects that Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of the Palestinian government, what's the likelihood that he'll move forward with these talks under pressure from the United States and other Arab governments, in the thinking that among some diplomats, some agreement at this point is better than no agreement at all?
Well, unfortunately for Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority, they have nowhere else to go. They have situated themselves in such a hole at this point in terms of their utter reliance on both the United States and Israel, both for money, military support. I mean, and by military support, I mean the training and arming of their security services. And this is the security service that keeps this small government in power. Because of that, and because they have a very minimal, at this point, popular base of support, they really don't have anywhere else to go. As part of these negotiations between Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, it was also reported that another $150 million was delivered to the Palestinian Authority. It's, of course, not a huge amount of money in comparison to what's being given to the Israelis, but the Palestinian Authority, based in Ramallah, of course, it's important to separate Abbas's government in the West Bank between and Hamas government in Gaza. the Abbas government receives an enormous amount of money from the U.S. in an attempt to build it up in opposition to Hamas. The key here is that Abbas is not only under pressure from Israel and the United States, but, of course, the Arab League, and he's been going to the Arab League to get some kind of support to help push the Israelis, and pushing the Israelis, meaning pushing the United States to push the Israelis to offer some concessions at the peace table. It's likely that Abbas will return to the peace talks. It's highly unlikely that peace talks will lead to anything, particularly since the 90-day, quote-unquote, moratorium on settlement building does not include East Jerusalem. So Abbas is in a tough spot, but it's a spot that he has put himself in and that the Palestinian Authority has put itself in vis-a-vis its attempts at negotiating with the Israelis through the deeply flawed Oslo Accords, which did very little but ensure the continual occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip.
Osama Khalil, if you were to prescribe a path forward for viable peace talks that would provide the Palestinians sovereignty in their own future state, overcoming a lot of political opposition to pressuring Israel, is there a way forward?
The only way to achieve this is, of course, by recognizing that apartheid in Israel exists and that apartheid anywhere is unacceptable. And so moving toward a strategy of boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and putting pressure on the politicians, as was done in South Africa, not waiting for the politicians. And for those of your listeners who remember Ronald Reagan's strategy of constructive engagement, which was neither constructive nor engaging, that the reality is by putting pressure on the politicians and the diplomats is really the only way that the dam will be broken here, and that real peace, a just peace, can be achieved, whether it be in Israel, Palestine, or anywhere else in the world. By sitting back and waiting for ineffectual politicians to finally stand up for what's right, it's a little bit like waiting for Godot.
That was Osama Khalil, co-director of the group Al-Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. For more information, visit the group's website at alshabaka.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our newly redesigned website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.